My name is Travis Hool, and I am presently recording a teaching staff session on the 30th of June, 2016. And today we're going to talk about Fire and Ice, a Natural History of the Railroad Creek Valley. I'd like to start by just asking y'all, when you hear geology, what do you think? And specifically, when thinking about this region. And feel free to just shout out.
Glaciers.
Foundation of the land.
Many kinds of rocks.
Water.
I.
What, me?
Yeah, you look like you're a citizen.
No.
You think about anything? What about in relationship to time?
Erosion.
Global warming.
Endless time.
Endless? Any others?
What do you mean by, just everything that's in the village that makes the village what it is? Mm-hmm. That has to do with y'all?
Yeah.
Like, the tectonic plates, like how the mountains are formed?
So a lot of things. I want to start by shifting gears into a different discipline, because I think it's a really good way to transition into geology. I'm going to play for you a piece by Igor Stravinsky, which is called Firebird Suite. It's just a segment. And I want you to think about some of those concepts, and then think about time, think about the crescendos and the decrescendos, the points at which different instruments are playing, the volume, the pace, all of those things. And then I'll talk about how that relates to geology. Put an image from Fantasia 2000, which has an animation for this piece, as some inspiration. What did you notice about the music?
We went from soft to crescendoing, and then back down again, and then dramatic again, and back down.
How quickly were some of the shifts into more dramatic pieces or parts of the piece?
Abrupt.
Fairly abrupt? Mm-hmm. And how about other parts of the content?
Sometimes it was just gradual.
Mm-hmm. So, Stravinsky's music is really interesting to me because it gets at the story of the electric time, which is difficult to understand unless you put it to something familiar. Disney felt as though it was so similar to describing the electric time that in the original Fantasia, they did a piece based on Rite of Spring by Stravinsky that dictated the entire geologic history of the universe, starting with the origin of the universe and walking through volcanic eruptions, very extreme moments in music, to subtle, long periods of time where you've got ocean forming, and dinosaurs, and all sorts of things. I feel as though it's a constructive way to start thinking about geology, the geologic time. It's something that's familiar, you can listen to it and feel the rhythm. But in order to really understand our place in time, I feel as though this graphic is a little bit closer to what we want. This takes the entire history of the universe and translates it into a year count. So 13.8 billion years as an exercise to figure out where we fit. If you look at the very beginning, the Big Bang, 13.8 billion years ago, if you go forward, not for another 4 to 5 billion years, do we then get the Milky Way, our galaxy? Then again, for almost all the summer, until about 4.8 billion years ago, do we even get our planet, our solar system? So we go through the fall into the month of December. Not until about halfway through the month do we start getting the organisms and the forms that we see on the planet as familiar. So land plants evolving, dinosaurs, which pretty much everyone's familiar with, the evolution of mammals, and then, very last minute of last day, the last, let's say, 5 seconds, is most of recorded human history. So if you consider where we're at, the entirety of the history of the universe, even if you're just looking at the history of our planet, the last 100 million years, what we understand is a very small portion. The story that we're going to go through today of this valley doesn't start until the 26th of December, about 220 million years ago. So I'm going to start by doing a general overview of geology. And if I use jargon, if I'm going too fast, or if you have a question, ask me. And let me know, because I want you to understand as much as possible. It's a really easy way to start thinking about the Earth is to compare it with a peach. Because peaches are anatomically almost exactly the same as the Earth. If you look at the skin of a peach, it's about 1% of the whole mass of peach. It's presumably colder because it's on an outside basis, colder temperatures, and is a little bit thicker and harder to cut through than the rest of the peach outside the pit. Similarly, the crust makes up about 5 to 25 kilometers of the total mass of the Earth, which is about 1%. As we start going inward toward the center into the fleshy part of the peach, it is softer, but it's not quite liquid, which is similar to the mantle, which is warmer, consequently it is softer. It's about third plus percentage of the mass of the Earth. It flows kind of like a really thick molasses, which is where we get a lot of the magma and the plate motion of the crust moving around it. So we go even deeper to the bad part of the peach. I know some people like that part. It's almost liquid-like. It's getting a lot softer. Similarly, as we get to the outer core, it becomes liquid. It's getting hotter as we go towards the center. And then you get to the very center, which is salt. In peach, it's because the seed needs to endure different environments. In the earth, it's because all of the mass of the earth is pushing together, heating it up, condensing it into a dense iron ball. It's about 11,000 degrees Fahrenheit. For perspective, the kiln firing we saw last night was about 1,600 degrees. Very, 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 very hot. Most of our story takes place on that 1%. So, if you think about it, everything in recorded human history, all life, lives on the surface, on the crust. That crust is made of different plates. There's two major kinds of plates. One is a continental plate, which is made of the material we're standing on. So it's crumpled up waste product from collisions and other things like that, sediment built up. And then we have oceanic plates, which are formed when the mantle, that molasses textured rock layer in the earth, heats up and sends this magma up. It needs to go somewhere. So it makes contact with the water and it starts spreading. That continues to go, and as it spreads, it goes underneath the continent. This is a process called subduction, because the denser material, it's denser because it's fresher out of the earth, and the chemical properties make it heavier, sinks underneath this lighter stuff, the continent. You have a collision between those two, which is a part of the mountain building process, because you're squeezing two things together, and they have nowhere to go but up. And then, as the oceanic plate sinks under, it melts, sending magma up through the continent, where it turns into rocks and comes out in volcanoes. So that story is pretty much exactly what we have going on where we are, where we're about here next to Glacier Peak, and we have this oceanic plate, which is the mantle coming up, melting, turning into material, and then sinking back underneath the North American plate. This is sinking about 1 inch per year, in fact, and that melted material comes up and produces the volcanoes. This collision produces the mountains that we see around us. So throughout this whole process, we get three kinds of rocks. We can see all three kinds in the valley. The first kind is igneous rocks. Igneous rocks are made right here, where the mantle, that magma is coming up, makes contact with water and cools down into the rock, or where it is being melted from subducting plate. It comes up into contact with the continental plate and cools either underground or above ground. The difference, above ground is volcanic, things like Mount St. Helens or Glacier Peak. In underground, you have plutonic rocks. They are named plutonic rocks after Pluto, the god of antiquity who lived in hell and took care of everything down there. And you get different sorts of rocks depending on how deep they are. So this is from Cloudy Pass, and this is granitic rock, a granite, and it cools slower, and over time, those crystals form to make sort of a salt and pepper texture on the rock. Whereas some that are closer to the surface and still were plutonic create things like tonalite, which is this sort of, it's almost just all gray because the crystals weren't able to differentiate. That's what Bonanza is made of. The second kind of rock that we have in the valley is sedimentary rocks. Sedimentary rocks are just rock material that's eroded away and builds up over time. So the Grand Canyon is a great example of that. You can see the layers that build up over time. That happens because you have an erosion of land that flows into the ocean, so sandstone or clay or other materials that build up in the layers, and then the shells of snails and plankton and other things can come back down into limestone. In our own valley, this is from just above Heart Lake, you can see the erosional process is happening, and the valley bottom is filled with glacial till and just debris from the sides of the mountains, which is what gives us a sedimentary rift down the line. This could continue to solidify, or in time it could wash down into the ocean, where it would eventually become solidified and turn into rock. There's lots of different processes, like water coming through it, erosion on the beach, wind can cut away things and throw dust around, glaciers can erode things, and landslides, gravity can just restore itself. If we didn't have these processes, then mountains would just keep getting taller and taller. Basically, gravity and erosion keeps the Earth a round spherical shape instead of having sort of wonky sides to it. Some places, like Mars, have their erosion hasn't been acting fast enough. And so Mars actually has a giant volcano on the side of it that sort of sets it off kilter because it hasn't eroded enough. The last kind of rock are metamorphic rocks, and that's what we mostly see here. They happen deep in the Earth, where layers of sediment have built up and built pressure, and then where it contacts with the mantle, which is magma, coming up. So that combination of heat and pressure creates all sorts of different varieties of rocks. If you look at shale, which is just a sedimentary rock compacted in clay, as you subject it to increasing temperature and pressure, it becomes different sorts of rocks. So the general trend is that it gets more deformed. You see these sort of curves in the rock bands. It gets more compressed and it creates new types of crystals. To illustrate, this is limestone. This is a class that I had in Italy. These are beds of limestone. You can see the cracks and the layers there. And over time, they were heated and pressurized to produce marble, which is just a continuous block. You can't see those layers. It's just all crystalline in a very homogeneous structure. In our own valley, good examples of that are gneiss, which is these banded formations. This is from just past Cloudy Pass up the valley. And then schist, or slate, this is sort of the middle ground where you've got these clay layers that have built up and then been compressed and heated to form sort of flakes that are cemented together. So if we think about our own context in the North Cascades, we have all of these processes, igneous rocks coming up, depositional environments where we've got sediment coming from the continents and building up. We have deep pressure that's creating metamorphic rocks. Look back to this image, you can see the sorts of places where you find them. Sediment through your rocks would obviously be closer to the surface where there's stuff being eroded away. Igneous rocks are where magma is coming out of the earth, and then metamorphic rocks would be where these are colliding and creating pressure, and then where magma is coming out to create heat. If we zoom in, we can see where we're at is in what they call the metamorphic core, which is a block that is, because it's the high point of the mountains and it's been subject to the most erosion over time, it's dug down into what are deeper metamorphic rocks that were heated and pressurized deeper down. This map is a very confusing geologic map of our valley. I'm not going to explain it to you necessarily because it hurts my head too, but the basic idea is that over time, metamorphism has created a super messy picture. All these lines are faults, places where rock has overridden other rock to compress it and jumble it up. And you can see all the different sorts of formations. So up at Lyman, we have granite plutons, which are these magma chambers underground that cool slowly to create granite. Whereas like down in the valley, we just have debris flow from glaciers and eroding sediment. Copper Peak is heavily metamorphosed ocean deposits, which we'll get into in a second. So this is from a book called Geology of the North Cascades, Mountain Mosaic, which is there. It's a actually pretty interesting read on understanding the geology here. And this is a timeline that goes covers our story. So our particular alley goes from about 240 million years ago up to present, which is on the cosmic calendar, as we had from before, from the 26th of December to present, which is a very, very small portion of the total year and the 13.8 billion years of our history. So going into the specific history of our galley, starting at about 220 million years ago, or 4:30 a.m. on December 26th of the cosmic calendar, we have the deposition of a lot of layers that we see in the valley. So things in Copper Peak, there's marble, the ore body from the copper, there's schist, there's other metamorphosed rocks. That is all derived from ocean sediment and magma coming up in the South Pacific, which is confusing because we're all the way up here. The interesting bit about that is that over time, as the plates move around, over the last 200, 300 million years, the Pacific plate has moved in this direction, and the North American plate has moved in this direction. And with it, things that were made in the South Pacific got brought up, slammed up against the North American plate. Some of those pieces broke off, including the one that is sitting over there. The sorts of environment that would have been made of is deep ocean vents, like in this picture, or spreading centers in the center of the ocean. This whole faulting process, these two plates moving past each other, has ripped up parts of the edges, which is why we have major faults that go through here. I'm sure you probably have heard of the Cascadia Fault, which received a lot of press from an op-ed in the New York Times about it. It's impending doom to destroy us, which there is a pretty high likelihood that there will be severe earthquakes in the next 100 years here. That's all because of this plate motion. So that's where we get sort of the origin of our ore body, which is why we're here. As we go forward to about 90 million years ago, 2:55 p.m. on December 29th is when we have a lot, the beginning of the Onda-Fuca plate starting to go underneath this continent. So it brings with it a lot of that ripped off material that had originated in the South Pacific, and it slams together continental material and this plate material. As those things pile up, sort of like a snowplow making these layers, it starts causing metamorphic pressure because you're increasing the pressure and you're also getting closer to where there is magma. That has created a really jumbled up picture, which is, this is a cross section, so the Pacific is flipped, sort of irritating, but well, I guess it's directionally that way. So the Pacific is this way, North America is this part, and you can see all of these different layers have been really heavily squished heated and pressurized and then eroded over time, which is how we get these layers present in our valley. So again, that process continued, just like this image from before, and from 65 to 35 million years ago, from December 30th, 7 a.m. to December 31st, I guess today in the cosmic calendar, 1:50 a.m., is magma starting to come up through the rock. And that produces a lot of interesting features. So as that magma comes up and begins heating those pressurized layers, you get all different sorts of rocks depending on how close you are to the magma or how deep you are with the pressure. So you have things like this, which are nice. The layers, the salt and pepper grains from the granite are compressed and heated. You have really hot and pressurized, nice, that has these foliations, just curve over time. And then you just have schist, which is shale or clay layers that have created these bands in the rock. And at about 35 million years ago is when we start getting this plate going underneath, melting even more severely, enough so that there's magma coming up to produce volcanoes. That's where we get a lot of these volcanic rocks that are around Mount Rainier and Glacier Peak, Mount Baker, and where we get big slices, plutons in the rock that cut through the existing layers. It's this process of the plate subducting underneath is where we have Mount St. Helens originating, Glacier Peak, and those continued eruptions are because that plate is continuing to go underneath our continent, producing these rocks still today. The last phase that is probably the most tangible is glaciers shaping the landscape for the last 1.6 million years. That's only been happening since 11:15 p.m. before midnight today in the cosmic calendar. Not very long. That whole process is just from a general cooling in the climate that produced big ice sheets in that period. Ice sheets like the Cordillerian ice sheet that went all the way down and sort of in this area, its southernmost extent, actually our valley and glacial land. So those glaciers are responsible for a lot of the carving and erosion that produced what we see today. That's just because as snow and ice piles up over time, creates a big mass that kind of rakes down as a plow through the valley, pushing up sediment, stripping it up. As it melts away, it leaves these big U-shapes from where all that weight as a plow is coming down. And you can see that really evidently. This is just west of our valley. This is Fortress Mountain, and you can see this big U from glaciers carving it out. So all of these processes have led to the formation of the valley as we know it today, which is this vast U-shaped valley with the eroded peaks that present all of these different sorts of rocks and rivers and the sediment that fill our valley. You can see evidence of the Hanging Valley, the glaciers carving through between Buckskin and Copper in the shape of that U. You can see a lot of the eroded spaces in areas that the glaciers either carved out, like this U just next to Bonanza. The erosion of these rock layers is where we find a lot of our rivers and streams and avalanche chutes, which then deposit all of this material at the bottom, and that influences what grows there. So there's not necessarily thick soil, and because it's so easily eroded, it presents a great place for avalanches to run down, which is heavily influences what we find there. This is at Holden Creek on the way to Heart Lake. You can see all of this debris from the glaciers pushing the material down. It's built up over time, and only in the places where rivers have sliced through it can you actually see that material. And really only, I mean, you see it on the slopes, but especially in the valley bottoms, this is a stand of lodgepole pines not very far past that, which, like sort of thicker layers with clay in it, and this is just possible because you have this buildup of debris. Other effects of this history, obviously, is just the snow and the rain that we get here. The reason that Seattle is rainy is because we have mountains that catch the clouds coming off the ocean and dumps a lot of snow and rain. The reason that sort of Chelan and East is a lot drier is because that moisture is dumped in these peaks and doesn't make it that far. And then we still see evidence of that glacial activity, like up at Lyman, where we still have a small glacier that's receding, but a lot of the melt that we get in our creeks is from glaciers, from the snow that's being caught on those mountains, and that produces the streams that slice through the valley. This is Railroad Creek, and the stream that powers our village and gives us our water. So the last thing I want to talk about is our impact in relationship to the geology. It's pretty evident here. Obviously, because of the ore body that is a product of this geologic history, we had mining. That's the reason the village is here. Because of that process, we've left a lot of material hanging around, which you can find even on the other side of the creek. This is outside of Chalet 3. This is some of the orange windblown dust from the tailings that you can find sort of scattered around the village. And it is, I guess you start getting into our relationship with this geologic history and how now, despite all of those cataclysms and that long period of time, we're starting to speed things up. When thinking about the climate, which heavily interacts with this landscape, because of increased CO2 concentrations, we have increased temperatures that exist on the planet today. This is a graph that shows global average temperatures over time and relationship to the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, which has gone up over time. And that is reflected in weather data from this area, which is sort of the impacts of that climate change is really evident. This is from Stehekin, which shows the general decrease in temperature, and it doesn't seem that extreme, but when you start thinking about the changes that small changes in temperature can influence, then you have this graph, which shows, this is from the North Cascades Port Complex. They released a document on the impacts of climate change in relationship with the landscape last year. You can find it on the Forest Service website. So this is sort of the historical makeup of where we have snow dominant, kind of where we are, mixed rains down on the borders, and then rains dominant on either side. And you can see that shrinking. This is like the least warming scenario. And as we get into more warming, depending on the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, we have a substantial change in how much snow we receive in the area, which is also reflected in this graph. And as we're all aware, this summer, a big part of that shift is increased flooding. So the general trend for the North Cascades, Pacific Northwest in general, is the same amount of precipitation, but increased severity. And this year, with the fire, we have an even greater risk because we don't have as much material to hold back those rains. You can see over time, this is the modeled prediction for an increase in flood severity in the region. This is a picture by Lindsay from the fire, just thinking about the trend in increasing dryness between those periods of severe rain, increasing temperature creates better storm for fire. Presently, this diagram sort of shows a lot of the how climate change then impacts with our geologic landscape. So by having increased fire, you have increased risk of landslide, increased risk of slumping, less snow, you have less material at the top, so you have more flood potential. You have more bank erosion. When you have increased precipitation amounts, then that causes washouts and other problems like that. So I just want to end by thinking about, by going through that entire history, it's a lot, but you start to understand the long processes that lead to what we find in the valley today. And then it's important to understand how we're interacting with that. So now I'd like to welcome any questions you have or any discussion that you might have about this whole story. It's long and complicated. Yeah.
How do you deal with folks that think that the world is 6,000 years old? I mean, that just must be such a contrast you run into very reasonable people who have a very specific explanation for that, but for me, it's such a radically different.
Yeah.
Way of looking at the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, so the first thing is differences in different ideas of evidence for an understanding of the world. So science, as an example, all of the information I presented is based on collecting data, observations. So like our understanding of the layers of the Earth is based on radar being sent into the Earth and understanding those different layers and collecting that data. Religion and biblical evidence explains, it is a way of thinking about the world that is different than the type of evidence that you draw from this. So the first step is, like, for me, is to jump into talking about religious evidence, right? Because it's not so much a discussion about whether or not science is correct or incorrect. It's a matter of whether or not the religious context that you're in is compatible with that.
I don't know. I think that there are some scientific people who believe that carbon dating is just flat wrong, and I presume that they're doing that to match their religious requirements.
Yeah.
But they can come up with some very scientific, it's not a flat out simple cut and dried argument.
But in the scientific realm, the validity of something is based on the amount of evidence that you have and the way in which it's been tested and vetted. Whereas within religion, the validity of that is through personal experience and text and worship, and it's just something that is not necessarily contingent upon how many people or how much evidence. It's just different realms. In the past, I think the biggest thing is you have to talk with people about how they're interpreting that text, because if you're interpreting it fully in a literal way, there's a lot of other implications that come along with that. So I have found it constructive to like discuss with people who believe that and ask them about how they're interpreting that text and how that plays out into other areas of their life as a stepping point. But yeah, you're right. There are lots of scientists who interpret evidence in a way that does not necessarily match up with the data. Any other questions?
Do you find any semi-precious stones down in this valley that might be suitable for jewelry?
Yeah, actually, so there's a lot of marble, which if it's smoothed, it looks really nice. There's different crystalline structures that you can find. Obviously, we have the ore bodies, so there is gold and nickel and iron and other things, copper, obviously, up in the mine and in that area. I'm not sure about like amethysts or emeralds or things like that.
Was the copper depleted from this area that they quit mining, or were there other factors that caused the mine to close?
So, as I understand it, the mine closed because of economic pressure, and not because of the availability of resources there.
Yeah, I mean, copper is really valuable now.
Yeah. I think even before the record of decision was met, and Nancy maybe can speak to that too, but I think that one of the ideas, maybe it was far-fetched, was to process the tailings and pull out some of those valuable minerals that still are there. And you could, presumably, continue mining here. Well, thank you for coming, and learning some lessons.